So let me start with the footnote on back. If you flip over the notes to the back page, I've given you some resources there. Here's the deal is when I come to church every Sunday, I get nothing out of the message. I just don't because I'm up here. And so as a pastor, you need a place where you're filling yourself up, right? And so that's why one of the reasons I read so much, I come in almost every morning that I'm not meeting with somebody. I come in here and I sit and read. And then one of my other, when I'm out running or walking, I listen to Rob Bell's podcast all the time. And I jokingly say all the time that he's my pastor. And it's really not a joke. He's somebody that I'm paying attention to and listening to. And as much as like you come here and listen to me and agree or disagree and have conversations about what I've said, Jennifer and I don't generally go home and argue about what I've said. That'd be weird. And so for us in our home, Rob Bell is the person that we listen to and then we talk about in our life together. And so about a year ago, last December, Rob did a series called Guns and Politics on his podcast, and he started saying some things about politics that made me perk up and say, file that back, I need to talk about that next year when we get close to the election. And then a couple weeks ago, he's been doing this series on wisdom, which is really, really good, and if you don't listen to his podcast, you should at least listen to the stuff on wisdom. And he did one called How to Think About the News, which was really good for Jennifer and I, and we talked a little bit about like what we listen to and what we choose to allow in our headspace and what we should not be allowing in our headspace and trying to, shut out some things and let some other things in and those kinds of things. And then I told you all a couple weeks ago, I was in Indianapolis and I got to hear, Dustin and I both got to hear Rob do a talk called Politics is Spiritual. And the podcast the week after, he basically redid his talk from Indianapolis in podcast form. So I'm telling you all that just to say up front, some of the stuff I'm going to say at the very beginning here, I'm just blatantly stealing from Rob Bell because it's really, really good as a way of framing how we talk about politics. And I really, if you want to go deeper in that, I gave you all this stuff right there. There's the three podcasts I just mentioned on the back of your sheet. If you want to look him up and listen to what he has to say, because he's just a better speaker than I by a lot. And so you can go hear what he has to say and it's good. I'm going to, for the first 5 or 10 minutes, I'm going to steal his thoughts. And since I cited my work, I was told it's okay, as long as you cite yourself. So I'm not this smart. And then from there, we're going to branch out into our own ways and our own specifics. Okay. And I can feel the tension. I know that some of you are like, oh no, like we're going to talk about politics at church. And that just makes me wildly uncomfortable. I know. I get it. I feel that way too. So where I want to start is, with this idea of the nobility of politics. If you've watched the three presidential debates, my guess is the word nobility was not in your head. There has been almost nothing in this election cycle that has gotten to the nobility of politics, right? There's nothing that's made us inspired. I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat. Everything says nobody's particularly inspired by the person that's representing them. And we're especially not inspired by how the discourse has gone in public view. And so the idea of the nobility of politics is one that for me, I've had to really wrestle with. And that's what the podcast has been really good for me. Like, oh, politics really is a great and noble thing. We get the word politics from the word polis. The word polis is a Greek word, and especially in Plato, in the philosophers, it's a city in its idealized state. So when we talk about the Greek city-states, which you talked about in sixth grade civilization or social studies, theoretically, you talked about the city-states of Greece. The word that was used there, probably not in your class, but the Greek word there is polis. The other Greek word that we get to politics is this one, politikos. And politikos then is of or relating to the citizens of the state or the city state. So anything that has to do with how the polis is run, how the people live in the city or the city state, everything that has to do with those people and how they live together is the politikos. And so here's the best part of what Rob Bell says, all right? He says lots of good things, but here's the best part. Then politics is our shared life together as citizens. Politics is how we all get along. Now, next week, we're going to spend some time talking about American politics, and we're going to talk about why politics has become a thing that we say as an insult to somebody, like you're being political. Like, we're going to talk about why politics kind of gets us in the gut next week more. But this definition for me has become huge, and I've actually tried to replace the word politics in my language as much as possible with our shared life together. Some of us in this room, I heard somebody say apathy, and I didn't have my eyes open, so I don't know who it was, but some of us can grow really apathetic towards a politics. And some of us, I know, say things like, I just don't care. But you do, right? So when it snows this winter, which they say there's going to be lots of snow, and they also say that it's going to be snowing in November, despite the fact that it's October 30th and I'm still in flip-flops, they say that it's going to snow shortly. We care about when the snowplow goes down our street, right? Right? Then you care about politics. We care if the snowplow chooses to go down the street of the wealthy neighborhoods in our city and not in the poor neighborhoods of our city. That matters to us, right? Then we care about politics. If you care about roads and water and schools and whether your neighbor mows their yard or not, you care about politics. Politics is our shared life together. There's politics to everything we do. There is a politics to our family, right? There is a shared life together that Jennifer and I have with our four boys. And there's things that have to do with that. So out of politics, the one last word I want to put up on the screen is the word policy. Because policy then is the rules that describe and probably define our shared life together, right? So what politics is supposed to be about is it's supposed to be conversations about the policies that define and describe our life together. So our family has a politic, right? Here's what it looks like in our family. When we sit at the kitchen table together as a family and eat as a family, you will chew with your mouth shut. That is the policy. You break the policy, you do 10 push-ups. That is also part of the policy. You all laugh, but that's actually true. We give warnings, but we figure it's good. Double whammy, right? Exercise and punishment. We have policies that say when you finish eating and you carry your dish to the sink, you put it in the dishwasher. I'm not here to clean up after you. We have a policy that says on Wednesday mornings, you carry your laundry out of your bedroom up to the laundry room so your mother doesn't have to carry it up. She'll take it down for you, but she is not carrying it up the stairs. We have all kinds of, we have policies about when they can be on their screens and not be on their screens. We insist that they be on their screens before 9 a.m. so mom and dad can sleep in. We also insist they get off their screens because they're annoying, right? We have policies in our shared life together as a family. Now, in our family, it's a benevolent dictatorship, right? Or actually, I guess it would be a benevolent oligarchy of two, right? We're kind, but we make all the rules. And as our boys grow, part of what we're doing as parents is we want to involve them in that process. So when we have family meetings together, we ask them about our policies together. What policies are working? We don't use this language. That'd be a little weird. But what's working in our family? What's not? What do we need to make work? How do we make it work? How do we all have the things that we want? How does Caleb get to play his drums in a way that's respectful of everybody else in the family, right? Like there's a conversation that we're having about we all live in a space and the drums dominate the whole space. So how do we navigate that together? Now, obviously, I can talk about my family and it's easy. It gets a lot harder the bigger the group gets, right? So let me use this example really fast. I would like a survey really quick of all of you couples. I'll stick to couples. When it comes to money in your relationship, how many couples over the course of your marriage have agreed on every decision you've made about your money? Hands. Steve Harris. Only because she's not here. Well played, sir. We'll let her know. Multiply that times 150 million. And you see how complicated politics gets in a hurry, right? Jennifer and I haven't agreed on every money decision we've made, and probably even daily we have different nuances of, mostly we're in agreement, but we have different nuances of we choose to do this, I choose to do this. And we negotiate and we work together and we talk and we process and we make decisions and is now the time to buy a car? I don't know. Right? And then you expand that times 100, what, the population of America is like 300 million plus. So take the two of us and multiply times 150 million and just take that complexity. I was thinking today, if you could have sliders for like major budget categories, so here's the tax slider and the defense spending slider and the education slider and the social services slider and the whatever other sliders you want to put out there. And I said, everybody in the church, come up and set the sliders however you want. We would have 150 different sets of sliders, wouldn't we? But we share a space and we share resources. And so this politics thing is about how do we get in the room and how do we get our shared life together in a way that benefits the biggest number of people. And we're going to talk next week, and again, I'll steal from Rob Bell a little bit next week and add my own, but I'm going to talk about the frustration of when we feel like people aren't doing this. So it's frustrating to me, I'll just give you a preview, it's frustrating to me that in three presidential debates, we've talked about policy now for about 15 minutes. It's supposed to be about policy. There was a time in our country where politicians, Lincoln-Douglas debates went on 3 to 4 hours, and it wasn't talking about emails and what you said or didn't say, but it was talking about, here's the policy, here's why my opponent believes X, here's why I believe Y, and let me give you 5 reasons why. I got to tell you, when you read American history, Americans used to be so smart. They used to talk about Voltaire, and they used to talk about philosophers, and they used to talk about big ideas, about policies, and why we disagree fundamentally about this policy, and now we're talking about stupid stuff that doesn't matter. All right, calm down. Sorry. That's next week. Calm down. Thank you. That's next week's talk. So that's what we're going to do over the next couple weeks, is talk about, like, in our shared life together as citizens, what are the policies that describe our life together? And how, as Christians, do we engage in this? I'll just take a real quick second, and you don't have to turn there. When I was in seminary, I took Greek and Hebrew, both. Greek for all 3 years I took Greek, and then a year or two of Hebrew. I've forgotten all of it. At least the Hebrew. The Hebrew's really hard. Greek is not so bad. So my Hebrew class, one of my Hebrew classes, after I got out of the basic grammar classes, that you do translation. So when you do Greek, you guys did James, right? Like, everybody does James, I think, in Greek. Oh, you did Mark. Oh, Mark's the other one, right. So both James and Mark have a very limited vocabulary. They're like the dumb letters in the New Testament. And so that's where they start first-year Greek students off, is in those books, because they're smaller words. And it just made us all look dumb. Sorry, it threw us all under the bus, all three of us. But that's where you start. And so in my Hebrew class, we were translating Exodus, like, I think we started the semester like Exodus 18 or 19 and ran through like 25 or 26 over the course of the semester. So in that is the Ten Commandments. So it's a little easier for beginning Greek students to translate what's already familiar to you. It helps. And so I was remembering back from my seminary days, like, how ridiculous all this is. So just listen to this. This is from Exodus. This is the Holy Scriptures. Whoever steals an ox or sheep and slaughters it or sells it must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. If a thief is caught breaking in at night and is struck a fatal blow, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed. But if it happens after sunrise, the defender is guilty of bloodshed. Anyone who steals must certainly make restitution, but if they have nothing, they must be sold to pay for their theft. If the stolen animal is found alive in their possession, whether ox or donkey or sheep, they must pay back double. If anyone grazes their livestock in a field or vineyard and lets them stray and they graze in somebody else's field, the offender must make restitution from the best of their own field or vineyard. If a fire breaks out and spreads into thorn bushes so that it burns shocks of grain or standing grain or the whole field, the one who started the fire must make restitution. If anyone gives a neighbor silver or goods for safekeeping. You get the idea here? What is this all happening in Exodus? Policy about our shared life together. It's the Israelites' equivalent of, if you chew with your mouth open, you will do push-ups. That's what this is. And so much of the Pentateuch, in fact, is dealing with a lot of people sharing a space. How do we do life together? I'm just pointing at all of this to say that there's a nobility to politics. Politics is a good thing. And politics done well is a noble thing. When we get people in the room and we work out our differences in a way that we do the most good for the most number of people, that's something that we all hope for. When our politicians get together, and I know it's incredibly dorky. Rob Bell says, you want to end any political conversation, by the way, is just steer it into policy. Well, that's interesting that you say that, because here's the policy involved. Like, people just zone out. Like, that's not our current political temperament. And I'm going to talk about Christians in the political sphere next week. And I think part of our job is to bring the conversation back to policies about how do we do the most good for the most number of people. That's the nobility of politics. And I think preview of next week, that's part of what it means to be a Christian in the public sphere, is to bring the conversation back to the nobility of politics. But how do we get more people in the room to work out our differences, because we have differences. I was told, I'll say one last thing and then I'm going to move on to this week. This is all introduction. I was told, and I know some of you are big Bernie fans, Bernie Sanders fans, and you can come after me afterwards. I don't think I'm saying anything wrong. But I heard somebody say one of the reasons people liked Bernie Sanders is that Bernie Sanders, when people would ask him questions, every question, like, did you feel in the presidential debates that whatever the question was, neither one of them would answer the questions. They would turn it into something else and really, really annoying. I'm trying to teach my boys on how to watch a political debate and like trying to point out these things. And it's just bad example. See, there they go interrupting again. There they go not answering the question again. Like, it's just this negative example. And one of the things I was told that people appreciated about Bernie Sanders is when people would ask him questions, he would clearly identify the policy involved. And he would say, this is policy option A that hasn't worked anymore. So we could go to option B or option C. I choose option B because of 1, 2, and 3. My opponents believe in option C because of this, this, and this. That's noble to me, right? We all have profound differences about economics and defense spending and whatever you want to name. We, even in this room, we have a lot of difference on how we believe. But if we can get together in the same space and identify the policies involved and then have noble discussion about how we live in a space where we honor my wife's desires for our money and my desires for our money and our kids' desires for our money, and we can share the space together, that's a noble conversation. Amen? That's what we're after. So, what we're going to do over the next 3 weeks is we're going to talk about this in 3 spheres. I was going to just do 2 spheres, and then I sat with our formation team, and we talked a couple weeks ago, and we decided to expand it into 3 spheres. So this morning, we're going to start by talking about church politics. I know that makes everybody, I just saw a look of horror on Susan's face, right? We're going to talk about church politics, and you have to answer first the next question. All right, we're going to talk about church politics, and then next week, which will be 2 days before the election, we're going to talk about American politics, and specifically, what is it to be a Christian in the political sphere? And I'll just tell you, there's a doozy of a sermon working up in my head, and I'm going to try not to yell and talk fast, but there is something burning in me that I want to say, and I've been holding it back in lots of places, but it's burning, all right? That sounds weird. Thirdly, then the week after the election, we're going to talk about kingdom politics, about what it means to be citizens of a greater kingdom. Jesus always talked about, my kingdom is not of this world. We're going to talk about that idea and what it means, you know, just keep going in our Christians in America talk. So that's what we're going to do the next 3 weeks, all right? So let's get into church politics. So first question. Okay, so there's, depending on the church, it feels like there's right ways and wrong ways, narrow interpretations. What else? In our church experience, when we say like, oh, church is just political, or that's all church politics, what makes our stomachs churn when we hear the words church politics? Lust for power. Oh, so when people use that Trump card, and like nobody has that in the American political sphere, but in the church, somebody gets to pull the God says, and I know what God wants in this. Yeah. Oh, historically, women are not a part of it at all. Our shared life together. Good. What else? Yeah, this betrays, like, I think if we recovered the nobility of politics, then church politics is a noble, I'll tell you what I'm going to say in a minute. No, I guess I'm saying it now, so then that's not what I'm going to say in a minute. Well played. I'll wait a minute and say it. If we really believe in the nobility of politics, then church politics is the nobility of working out our shared space together. Yes. Yeah, especially, so he just said it's about we hear divisiveness, so it imports the ugliness of what happens in the American political sphere and then says churches do that. And to be fair, I've been in churches where it looks just like that at times, and some of us have had that experience. A couple more. Yeah. It lacks love. Oh, man. I was listening, I think it was on NPR, talking about how so much of the political landscape now, and this will be next week again, it's just about winning. It is, you and I have had this conversation, like I get really, here's one of my most frustrating things, is when I believe that the whole Supreme Court thing where the Republicans are like, we're not going to nominate anybody, and the Democrats were so offended, if you just change the places, they would all hold the opposite views, right? Totally lacks love, it's just about winning. Let's not pretend that we're really principled on this, we just want to win. And so then that doesn't feel like there's anything that's loving in secular politics, and then you import that in the church, and it's like, well, that just seems contrary to who we are. Yeah, because sometimes, so that there's, what Monica just said, is that there's this disconnect between the stated politics and then the real politics. And I should say that sometimes in our shared life together, there is very clear, this is who we are, there's clear policy, and then sometimes there's the real policy, right? Yeah, we don't know how to deal with conflict in church very well. That's good. Yeah, in our shared life together, sometimes people's feelings get hurt. Can I tell you a personal story? Sometimes I think that this whole thing too is when we don't understand why decisions were made the way they're made, then it feels like somebody said it being raw grab for power. It feels like a power thing. And sometimes it's hard in our shared space together. When I was first starting out in ministry, probably within the first month or two of me going on staff at the church I was a part of, just a couple years before, they had fired a staff member. And it was really, really contentious. And this staff member, like, tried to lead a revolt. Like, went to people in the church and was like, if I started a new church, would you come with me? Like, that kind of ugliness. That's when it starts feeling like raw grabs for power and the ugliness of church politics, right? And it feels divisive and unloving and all those things. And I was with our executive pastor, and he was my boss. And we were in the car together one afternoon for, like, 3 or 4 hours coming back from somewhere. And we were talking about the situation. He was kind of bringing me up to speed on here's what's happened in the church over the last couple of years. You need to know some of these things. And one of the most difficult things is as the church, they couldn't say everything, right? They couldn't just get up and say, here's why we got rid of this staff member. They just couldn't. And he told me, he said, there's a file and it's thick. And he's like, this conversation doesn't leave this car, but here's what's in the file. Now, people on the outside can look in and say, well, that was all just church politics getting him out of there. But it was a hard situation, right? Because the church is in a weird spot of, well, no, it's not. It's more black and white than you think it is. We just can't say the reasons it's black and white. And so it's hard. And so sometimes because we see politics as so negative, it becomes a way just to criticize somebody, even though there is nobility to our shared life together as a church. There's a nobility to working out how we live as a church together. So let me say some things about our shared life together as a church. And the first thing I want to say is that our shared life together is always evolving. It's always growing. I was doing something the other day and I came across a picture of our family on the first Sunday morning of our church in the Gateway building. Our family has evolved since then. I told Jennifer if we ever recreate the picture, she's going to have to figure out a way to hold Matt Jackson on her hip. Jackson is now 85 pounds or something and almost as tall as she is. And to recreate this picture, she's going to have to get him on her hip and hold it. Like, we've evolved as a family physically. I'm a lot slimmer than I was then. Yay. We've changed. I also have this thing going on here that I'm not super happy about. That's evolved. Oh, there you go. You win. And so just start extrapolating that, right? So not only has our physical situation evolved, but then what we need as a family has evolved as well. What we needed when we were parents of young kids is very different than what we need today as a family. We have, and what we used to think about some things back then, we had amazing opinions about parenting teenagers back then. We don't know what we're doing now. We have no idea. And so in the same way, in our shared life together as a church, it's always evolving. If I bet if we worked it out, there's only like a small percentage of you who are actually a part of that church 8.5 years ago. We're a different church. We're a different group of people. Even the people that have been here for a long time, like, we're different people, right? Like, very different people than when we started the church 8.5 years ago. Different things are important to me than were important to me 8.5 years ago. And when you're a group of people journeying together, things change, situations change, the cultures change. Some of us have different jobs, some of us have different, all kinds of things. Like, we've just evolved. And so this thing, our shared life together, is never a done thing. We don't ever get to a spot where we say, like, we hammered it out. We're done now. We've got it all figured out. Because we're always evolving, always changing, always growing. This conversation about how we share our life together is always changing. In like 6 months, as a family, we're going to have a conversation about our shared life together and how we share cars. Eek! I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to have to share my car, right? But that's going to be our reality, right? Like, it's changing, it's growing, it's evolving. And the same thing's happening here all the time. Second thing is that it's subjective. There isn't one way to do church. There's no one right way to do church. And we have reasons why we do things the way we do. And I think they're good reasons. Wouldn't have led us into those ways if I didn't think they were good. But that doesn't mean that they're the only way. So sometimes it's hard because we come into our shared space together and we say, but this church does it that way. That's great for that church. That doesn't necessarily mean it's our way. And so we're always wrestling with this very subjective nature on what is the best way to do our shared life together. There's a lot of ways that plays out, and I've gone really long so far, so let's go. Here's a weird one for churches. Our shared life together. When we talk about our shared life together as a family, I only really care about 5 people. That's our conversation. And me, 6. I care about mine, me too. So I care about 6 people. What's hard for us as a church sometimes is when we talk about our shared life together, we also care about the stranger. And I don't mean this in the weirdo. I mean stranger as in I don't know those people. So I'm talking here about people who haven't come here yet. I'm talking about the people that we minister to. Somebody said to me recently, this was really inspiring to me, this idea that there's a lot of people in Peoria who need a church just like this, and they don't know that we're here. And I got to tell you, our leadership team is talking about that idea, because that's just got stuck in me over the last couple months. Like, there's people that need a church just like this, and they don't know how to find us. And we've stayed pretty good at being hidden for many of our years. And so trying to sort that out and figure that out. So part of our shared life together includes a stranger. And then our shared life together includes just about everything we do here. So this morning, part of our shared life together is somebody decided that somebody was going to get here and open the building and turn on lights and start the coffee at 6 o'clock this morning. And somebody, Christina, organized volunteers to come here as part of our shared life together, the thing we do together, to get here and start making eggs. Did you know you can bake eggs in the oven? I learned that from Christina this morning. And some of you, part of our shared life together, got up at like 3 o'clock this morning and turned on sausage in your crock pot so you could bring sausage this morning to serve. Did you know that somebody is thinking right now about when this is all over? They're going to stick around after you all leave, and they're going to make sure all the lights get shut off, because we've all pooled our resources, and it seems wasteful to leave these lights, especially are expensive. It seems wasteful to let these lights run until I come in to work tomorrow morning, right? And so somebody, I think it's Eric Gerke today, is going to hang out here while you all talk, and then after you get done talking, he'll make sure the building gets locked and the lights get shut off, because part of our shared life together is somebody needs to do that. And do you know that there's people here today who came to church this morning got dressed, got out of bed, and they're in there watching your kids so that we can have this conversation. So we can have a shared life together. They're willing to give up their shared life together for the morning. And they're going to sit in there and they're going to watch your kids and maybe this hour, maybe next hour, and they're going to go home and they're going to miss all the adult conversation in this place because part of our shared life together is we have lots of children and somebody needs to pay attention to the children so that we can have a conversation. Did you know how hard it was to do the prayer earlier with all the little ones in here? It was hard to focus. And we love that and we want that, but then there's a time where the adults need to have a conversation, and part of our shared life together is somebody needs to pay attention to that, and somebody needs to say, you know what, I'll be the one to do that. And when it snows outside, Doug and Emily will get here at some ungodly hour in the cold and shovel snow because they care about our shared life together. And so part of our shared life together is to show up early and get here and get the snow cleared. And I think what happens sometimes in churches is we forget that what we have here is a shared life together. And for all of these things to happen, somebody has to do something. Somebody has to put money in the offering box so that we can turn on these lights and turn on the heat and the air conditioning and pay our staff to organize the stuff to do the things so that we can have a shared life together. It's nice to think sometimes that maybe things just happen out of thin air. But they don't. And part of our shared life together is that we're all doing bits and pieces. So, this has to be a talk also then about money and giving. Because part of our shared life together is surely is the resources it takes to make a place go, right? It's funny. I mean, that's part of the American conversation too, right? I mean, how much of our politics is talking about money and economics and taxes and rates and plans? It's about, because that's a big part. And they say, I've never seen the exact stats, but they say that that's one of the biggest problems in marriages that end in divorce is conversations about money. And all of you all know, if you've been married for any amount of time, that yes, there's a lot of things to argue about in marriage. We can almost invent some days, right? But when it's money, it's, boy, there's hard conversations sometimes about money. And do I take this job or that job? And do we spend on this? Do we buy this house? Do we do this thing? All of those things are a lot of work. And so as a church, sometimes you have to talk about money too. And I want to lay all my cards on the table. As a church, I've always been hesitant to talk about money, not because I'm afraid of talking about money. I don't care about that. But because some of us have come from church backgrounds where talks about money felt really manipulative or excessive. And we weren't always sure that when it came to our shared life together, that the people that were leading us had the same priorities as we did. And I know some of you come out of church backgrounds where you've said things to me like, boy, the church I was at, they spent lots of money on really cool lights and smoke machines, but then they didn't do anything for the poor, and that bothered me, and I was concerned about that. And so, and then they were still asking for money, and it was another building, and all, you know, like, I've heard you all say that. And so there's been this thing as a church where we've, like, I don't want to talk about money a lot because there's so many things in life that is important, but then sometimes it is important to talk about money. And the truth is, as a church, for the first time in our church history, budget is really, really tight. And I've said for years, like, the fun thing for me as a pastor is when I've talked about money, I've always got to talk about it in a way that was hypothetical, not like, whoa, things are tight. But if you've been paying attention to your notes over the last couple months, we're 3 months into our budget year and we're $30,000 behind projected giving. Now, I want to say, just so you know, that number will change next week. We've had two very generous gifts come in the last couple weeks, and those numbers will get lots better. But it's still, the trajectory is not great. Now, and you all know there's reasons for that, right? You all know that in this church, we attract the kind of person who's upwardly mobile in their career and isn't going to stay in Peoria. We have lots of people move away. We just do, and it stinks every time. Like, oh, man. And I know there's some of you right now plotting to move away. I know it. I see the guilt in your face. We wish you well. And we've also just come through a season of our church where we've lost people who were not just strong givers, but they gave their time and they gave their energy and they gave their passion and they gave their hearts to this church. And for reasons that are noble and for reasons of theology and all of that, they've had to leave us. And so we lost more giving than we lost percentage of people. Does that make sense? Our percentage of giving took a bigger hit than the percentage of actual people who left, because the people who left were very deeply committed to this church. And so part of this shared life together then is talking about resources and giving. So I want to talk about some stats. I love this line. They don't know who actually said it originally. Mark Twain made it famous. There's three types of lies: lies, damn lies, and statistics. So I want you to know that, you know, it's easy to go online and get church statistics about giving, and I hold them all with a grain of salt at some level. But there's some major trends that I want you to be aware of. First of all, charitable giving in America is on the rise. Overall, number of dollars that people give to charities in America is going up by about 2%, roughly. You want to know the bad side? At the same time, giving to churches is going the other way. And then this one was shocking to me. 20% of Christians admit to giving nothing to their church. So if that's true, 20% of you give nothing to the church. Now, what I want to say about that, this is our shared life together. When I'm part of something, and I'm not sharing in this, then I think the word we use is, right? I don't even know where that comes from. But some of us, when we say, I'm not doing that, I like it, it's good, love it, thanks. There's people that are carrying your weight, because part of our shared life together is we all give our time, our energy, our voices, our passion. We all, it'd be as if we're all sitting in a ship and some of us are sitting at the oars being like, the rest of you are good, keep rowing for me. And some of us are over there just rowing and rowing, and you're like, man, I'm glad for you rowers. Thank you. Keep doing it. I think this is the best boat ever. Keep rowing. The cynical part of me is sometimes even then those people that aren't rowing are the ones like, we should be going another direction. I wish we did more stuff. This is why I shouldn't ever see what people give in the church, and I don't, because that would just like make me want to crawl in my bed and cry. I hope that's not true of anybody in here. I really, I don't want to look at Kevin's face because he'll telegraph. He probably won't telegraph, but I don't want to know. So anecdotes. Evangelical churches are better than the stats. That's the hopeful part. Here's what I love about evangelicals. Sentences you never thought Charlie would say. Here's what I love about evangelicals. And I've heard this from my mainline friends. One of the things that even my mainline friends love about evangelicals is we all have a fire in our belly. That part of the evangelical ethos, going back to like Billy Graham, is that there's this drive within evangelicalism that says we can change the world. And that following Jesus matters. And that we ought to be about it. And it's not for just messing around and going to church sometimes when it feels good or I want to, but rather it matters to us. I say sometimes about Jennifer and I and our upbringing, like it mattered to us, like what we believe. And I know other people are like, it, like, why are you so bent out of shape about your faith or what you think? Or that's just not the evangelical impulse. The evangelical impulse is this stuff matters. And so anecdotally, and I understand this is anecdotally, but when I talk to mainline pastors, when I talk to like Catholics especially, they like, oh my gosh, evangelicals care. They volunteer. They give their money. They give their time. They get fired up about it. And it's awesome because sometimes in some of the other traditions, they just don't in the same way. Second, as I interact with more and more pastors are concerned that statistics and trends don't make the clergy feel hopeful and optimistic about what we're doing in this way of doing church. I can give you why. I think there's some whys to this, but Tuesday I was working on this talk, shared life together. We put resources in the pot so I can spend time on Tuesday working out all my thoughts and getting a talk ready. And so I was went to lunch with a Lutheran ELCA pastor, a PCUSA pastor, a Free Methodist, and a United Methodist, and me. What a fun lunch, huh? And so I said to them, like when we get together like once a month and like, just how's it going with you? What's going on in your life? And it's really good to have a space with other lead pastors to kind of talk about our challenges. And I said to them, like, I'm doing a talk on money. What do you all think? And then that was an hour later, we were done. And all of them talked about like, hey, when I look out projecting trends in my church and stuff, I don't know what happens. A lot of those churches especially are living off of, I don't know if the right word is bequestments. Is that the right word? Where people give a portion of their inheritance to the church when they die? A bequest, yeah. So a lot of those churches are living off of, hey, some of our older members die, and when they die, they give part of their inheritance to the church, and it's keeping us going. But what happens when this next wave comes around, and there is none of that anymore, and what do we do, and all this kind of stuff? And so there's a lot of angst among the clergy. And then the final thing, anecdotally, is giving away money is just hard no matter what the amount. I think when we have talks like this, it's easy in the church for those of us that don't have money to start wagging our fingers at the wealthy. Well, they don't, they should be giving more. Like 10% is not enough. They should give till it hurts. And then maybe it's easy for some of us that are wealthy to look at those and say, well, why don't you give what you have? Like, why are you letting me row so hard and you're not rowing at all? And we can easily turn this into a kind of a class warfare, or not even just class warfare, but just wagging our finger at everybody that isn't me. And I just want to acknowledge up front that giving money away is hard, period. Can I tell you a story, something my dad told me? And I think it's one of the, it's just really true. My parents grew up poor. My dad grew up dirt poor. His parents got divorced when he was 7 years old. He was one of four brothers. His mom remarried a bricklayer who lived in Kingston Mines, and he had three boys of his own and another boy that just lived with them. And I'm not even clear how that all worked. I think it was the 60s and it was a different era. And so in the house my dad grew up in, the son of a bricklayer now, eight boys growing up in the home of a bricklayer. He talks about like he had two shirts, all the boys had two shirts, and then they swapped them because that's all they had. And super, super poor. Mom and dad got pregnant Mom got pregnant when she was 16. They got married. My dad started out working in the foundry at Caterpillar down in Mapleton. And if you've ever been through Mapleton, it's a dirty, dirty. I mean, my dad came home dirty. And so we weren't ever dirt poor. But I mean, I remember the strike of the 80s when Cat was on strike and my dad couldn't go to work anymore. And I had to go on the reduced lunches at school and I was embarrassed. And so we were always like just, it always felt like things were a little tenuous for us. And then later on, my dad, his career went better and he made more money. And so by the end of his career, he was making pretty good money. Here's what my dad said about giving to the church. He said, Charlie, you would think that it would have been harder to give when we started out our career, but I'll just tell you, it was harder late in my career when we had more money, just because it was a bigger check. He's like, it was always the same percentage, but when the check got, then that number got higher and higher, it was harder and harder for me to give away because I started looking at it like, that's a whole vacation I could do, right? And so I just want to make sure in our church, as we talk about our shared life together, it's not easy. These decisions that we make about money are hard for all of us. The decisions about how much to give my time and talents to the church is hard for all of us. They're deep questions about our souls and what we think and how we understand God. And I'm going to talk about lots of motivations here in a minute and how they work on all of us, but I just want to say for all of you, like, I'm not afraid to talk about money, but I also recognize that this is a really tender place for a lot of us. And conversations about money in a home are hard all the time. I know this. So what motivates some of us to give? Some of us, by the way, I could totally Enneagram the rest of this talk because I think so much of this is Enneagram and I keep plugging the Enneagram, but that's all I'll say right there. I could Enneagram the rest of the talk, but if you want that, you'll have to take me out for lunch. Some of us are just motivated by duty. Everything I've said so far about our shared life together, like you're like, well, it's my duty. I should participate. That's good enough for me. I don't need anything more than it's what's expected of me. This is genius. I didn't know this. When I got to know the rabbi in town before he left, he told me that in the synagogue, when you come into the synagogue, you meet with the rabbi and you basically like give him your financials and he assesses you your 10%. Because that's the law. And if you're going to be part of the synagogue and call yourself a part of the synagogue, everybody gives 10%. That's just what it takes to be part of the synagogue. And so that's your duty. Done. Rabbis are also the highest paid clergy in the town. Just so you know. So I know that for some of you, just that idea. And I just want to say thank you. To those of you that give out of that space, thank you. Like that's, somebody's got to pay for the lights and the heat and staff and the building and somebody needs to pay for the light bulbs that we have some guys, talking about shared life together, we have some guys that are going to stick around after church and lower the light poles and put bulbs in them because they burned out. The ones right outside here and put them back up so that there's light here so it's not so creepy dark at night if you come here for a late meeting. Somebody had to pay for those bulbs out of duty. Because nobody ever stood up in front of church and said, I've got a great cause for you, light bulbs. Just takes duty. Some of you give out of mission that you believe in the shared role that we play in the community. That you say to yourself, there ought to be a church like Imago Dei in Peoria. There just ought to be. And if there's going to be a church like Imago Dei in Peoria, then I ought to be part of funding that thing. I ought to make sure that happens. We do this with lots of causes. We say, there ought to be a ministry like that in this community, so I'm going to give money to that. And some of you, that's your motivation. That, hey, there ought to be a church that preaches the way we preach and has the dialogue the way we dialogue and does breakfast the way we do breakfast and does a block party and does all the things that the church does. There ought to be that kind of church in this community, so I'll give to that mission because I believe in that mission. There's some of us that give out of a sense of gratitude. This is really at a deep spiritual practice kind of way, that some of us are trying to practice this space in our life where we see every bit of our money as a gift. And the only way to show gratitude is to give back. There's this lost art in our culture, and I'll be the first to admit I'm terrible at it. But sometimes we have people over for like dinner, and then a couple days later, a note comes that says, thank you for having us over for dinner. It was lovely. That used to be a thing in our culture where when you were thankful for somebody, you wrote them a card and you said to them, I'm thankful for you. And it's kind of a thing that's disappearing in our community. I'm not wagging any fingers because I'm really bad at it myself. But there's something in life about when you're thankful for somebody or you're thankful for what somebody does, you demonstrate that in a tangible way. Now, God is spirit, and it's a little harder to do that, but a way that people have used for centuries and centuries to demonstrate their gratitude in a spiritual way is to say, hey, I'm going to set aside part of my income and give it to the church as a demonstration inside of me of my gratitude for what God has done in my life. And so maybe some of you, that's the conversation with your spouse, is out of gratitude, as we're trying to cultivate gratitude in our life for all that we have, part of that is giving to the church, to join in our shared life together. Similar to it, but a little bit different, is some of us are trying to cultivate generosity in our life. We're trying to live in a way that says, I don't have to just keep getting more stuff from me. I don't have to keep collecting experiences from me, 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 me. I need more, I need more, I need more. But rather, I'm going to try to live my life so that I'm giving more and more and more away. That I don't need more stuff from me. There's a point where enough is enough. And I need to start developing a spirit of generosity in me, so I need to start practicing how to do that. And I start doing that by giving stuff away and not giving more. It's not a hard like a hard equation. The way you cultivate generosity is I stop buying more for me and start doing more for others. And then the last motivation, and I've gone long, I need to finish up, is sometimes we give to a cause, that there's the movement of the Holy Spirit in us. Jennifer and I have a fund that we put money into, and it's not a lot, but I don't even know where it is. Is it in your little folder thing? No. I don't know what happens with our money at all. We have big picture talks like you all do. I just don't know any details. It's our cause money. It's for when we get stirred to see to something, when we see a situation, when we see, when somebody asks, when, basically that. When movement of Holy Spirit happens in us, we have a little fund. It's not huge, but it's for us. It's just a little fund that sits there that we say, okay, we can meet a need because it's stirring in us and we want to meet that. So we'll just do that. I don't know which of those gets you. I would suspect at least one of them do, maybe more than one. I know for me, there's a couple there that really are, ooh. Go back to the beginning. I'm sure if you just pulled Jennifer and I, there's different ones that motivate us out of that list too. Here's what I'm asking. I'm just asking in this talk, in this season of our church life, I'm asking you to think about what is our shared life together as a church and how are you a part? How are you part of our shared life together as a church? And it's about giving, but it's also about how are you serving? How are you lending your voice? How are you supporting the church? How do you say thank you to the people in Genesis when you pick up your kids? And I went long this morning. Please say thank you for me. It's about all these things. And it's assuredly about giving. And so what I want to ask is this. I want to give you a very specific ask this morning. I haven't asked this in a long time, but I want to ask everyone in this church that sometime today or tomorrow or next week when the Cubs are all done and other things aren't consuming you, but sometime in the near future, would you sit down with your spouse? Or if you're single, just maybe have a conversation with a friend or even your own self. Write it out, journal it, think about it. Would you ask yourself about how am I participating in our shared life together as a church? The very specific ask is this. Would you consider growing 1%? If everyone in our church would look at it and go, now some people, maybe 1% is a joke, and you're like, oh, I can easily go 3 or 4%. When Jennifer and I started out, we moved to Colorado and we didn't even have jobs. Looking back now, if my own kids did what we did, we would tell them they were idiots and tell them not to do that, right? What were we thinking? And we literally had nothing. Just this week, Jennifer found some old pictures. Remember when there was pictures and you like a stack and you'd like flip through them? We'll have to teach our kids about those someday. And we were going through old pictures of our very first apartment that we thought was so awesome. It was awful. It was right? It was, we were just laughing at how like Spartan it was. There was nothing. And even the stuff we hung on the walls, like, what were we thinking? And Jennifer just made the point. She's like, Charlie, it's all we had. That's just all we had. And so we did whatever we could to get by with it. And I remember when we started at our church in Denver, I mean, we didn't have two nickels to rub together. And I can't remember what percentage we started at, but we said, we're going to give this percent to the church, and we're going to try, as we grow, to add a percentage point. And for a lot of years, we did that. We added a percentage. And then some years, it was harder, and we had to back up a percentage point. And then we added more. There's two things I want to say, and then I'll pray. Because I've gone really long, and I'm sorry. The two things I want to say is I want to cover this in a whole lot of grace. Some of us, to add 1%, it really wouldn't affect our lifestyle in any meaningful way. It just wouldn't. And that could be a really big number, and it just wouldn't. And I also know that there's been times in our lives where 1% would have killed Jennifer and I. There's been times in our lives where she's amazing. She budgets like crazy and finds every deal she can to keep as lean as possible. And she's, because of her, we've gotten through lots of hard times because I'm the free spender that, we're fine. And I know the pain of sometimes somebody asking for something I just can't give. I'm thinking of somebody in this church that I know, she's talked to me about her situation and it kills her that she can't do more. She wants to do more and she just cannot do more. And so I want you to hear me. If that's you, I get it. I do. And I'm not laying guilt on anybody, and I'm not shaming anybody. I'm just asking you to lay your hands open before Jesus and say, what do you want me to do? And if he says do something, to respond to it, and if he says it's enough, then it's enough. And then for all the rest of us, I just want to say that I think the way of Jesus is always calling us to come further up, further in. It's always further up, further in. And that Jesus is always going to ask us to sacrifice just a little bit more. It's funny because I think Jesus is so grace-filled that it's always, you're so good right where you at and a little bit more. And I love you right where you are, a little bit more. It's like helping your kids grow up, right? Like when they're learning to walk, like you don't shame them because they can't walk. You like love every step they take and a little bit more. I love you so much. You're amazing. Can you take another step? I love you so much. Can you take another step of responsibility in your life? And I love you just as you are, but can you take another step? And I think that balancing that picture of Jesus is really hard in my head sometimes, and really hard when we have these kinds of conversations about, can we follow Jesus a little bit more? And he loves you just as you are, absolutely unconditionally. But can you do just a little bit more? Let's pray. God, in everything in my life, I want to be a person that participates in the shared life we have together in my family and in my church and in my community, and help us to know the right ways to do that. Help us to be alert and aware of the Spirit and what you're doing in us. The true friend we talked about last week that comes alongside us and loves us and encourages us to take a little step more. And so help us to know that. God, I just pray that as a church, I've never been more excited to be a part of this church, and I believe in what we can do in this community, and I believe in the good that we can do. And help us to figure out how to share all the resources so that we can do the good that we dream of. In your name I pray, amen.